Every JFK researcher worth their salt knows about Alan Dulles, John McCloy, and the long fingerprints of the CIA on the Warren Commission. But Jeff Kay's October 2024 piece at his Substack, Hidden Histories, adds a layer that most of us have never heard. The Warren Commission quietly retained a part-time psychiatric consultant named Dr. Winfred Overholser and his successor, Dr. Dale Cameron, to advise on the mental life of Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby. On paper, Overholser was just the recently retired chief of DC's St. Elizabeth Hospital, but in reality, he had chaired the OSS Truth Drug panel in World War II. He supplied the brainwashing cover story that helped bury 25 US officers' confessions about germ warfare in Korea and ran a hospital that had a formal written agreement with the CIA's Office of Medical Services that allowed agency officials, not doctors, to involuntarily commit people for non-clinical reasons. Now, on Solving JFK, what we did on episode 85 with Jolly West and Jack Ruby was to zoom in on one CIA-connected psychiatrist getting close to one of the two men who could have blown the case open. I'm talking about when Jolly West met with Jack Ruby, something we'll talk about a little more today. But what Jeff has found is that this wasn't just a one-off. There appears to be a deep bench of MKUltra slash OSS era psychiatric professionals who were quietly embedded inside the official Warren Commission investigation. In this bonus episode, we're going to walk through Jeff's findings, his broader work on hidden US history, how he reads Jolly West, and what the overall implication is for the JFK story. And importantly, what would a lone gunman believer say about this whole conversation? Coming up next on Solving JFK.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting. The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Jeff, welcome to Solving JFK.
Hi, Matt. Good to be here. Thank you for inviting me on.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you on, and your reputation precedes you with your excellent Hidden History Substack. So, I guess can you tell us a little bit about, how you got started down this road of parapolitics slash alternative history slash what I would say looking at the documents?
Right. Well, I mean, I was always interested in history. My undergraduate was in history, but my career was in psychology, and I became a clinical psychologist. And many years ago, around the turn of the century, of 21st century, a colleague of mine recruited me to work at a torture treatment center in San Francisco, California. And that's doing evaluations and psychotherapy with torture victims who have come seeking political asylum to the United States, and helping them with their the psychological or psychiatric aspects of their casework with the government. And that meant interviewing many, many dozens of torture victims, working with some of them, a minority in psychotherapy, but really learning a lot about them. And it was while I was doing this that in the aftermath of the Iraq War, George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq, that the news hit about the US using torture in Iraq and of CIA black sites. And then the news hit that these torture program had been organized by psychologists. So myself and a number of other psychologists became much more involved politically, and I began to look into, because I was curious, the documents, because that was my background. If I was going to understand it, you can't really trust secondary sources very well. And so it's best to get the documents. The one thing I like about your show is you're always looking for the documents. You're always looking to substantiate the claims. And that's what I was seeking to do. I said, well, and one of those claims, which leads directly to Overholser and that finding today, was that one of those claims was that the torture program was constructed on the basis of old Chinese communist forms of interrogation and torture to elicit false confessions. And everyone agreed that this was, at least everyone on the left, but yes, this is exactly what's happening. This is the story. And I believed it too. But something said, I'd like to see the confessions. I want to know what they actually said. It would be of interest to me. It might even help me in my work with torture victims and when I'm in court. And I was an expert witness, running to the government, et cetera. But then I couldn't find the confessions. They were nowhere to be found, nowhere in the United States. I had to go to Britain. And I don't mean I went there physically, but I contacted the Imperial War Museum in London and was able to get a copy that they had. And I learned about people like Colonel Frank Schwabel, who was the highest ranking Marine Corps prisoner in the Korean War, and his confessions about use of biological warfare, which he knew intimately because he was a staff on command staff from the Marine Corps. Anyway, after the war, Schwabel was brought up on charges or potential charges by the Marine Corps. And the cover story was that his confessions of U.S. use of biological warfare were, in fact, elicited by Chinese communist torture. This is what I read in the New York Times. And one of the people who testified to that in court was Dr. Winfried Overholser, the esteemed psychiatric expert, the superintendent of St. Elizabeth's in Washington, D.C. And that was just a fact that I kept in the back of my head. It wasn't, that didn't say, oh, Overholser, I've got to look this guy up. In fact, I forgot about it for some months until one day I was pursuing a different matter and using the Mary Farrell website. And I came across Overholser's name in connection with the Warren Commission. I said, oh, gee, that's interesting. I never heard of that before. Overholser, that rings a bell. And I went back to my notes. I said, oh, yeah, that's the guy who testified for Frank Schwabel that he was tortured, even though he wasn't. And I can tell you, I know that for a fact now. Because later it turned out, I discovered that, and this was a major cover up, that the United States Air Force and Marine Corps had told its top officials, its pilots and air crews who were working on the biological warfare program, that in dropping the bombs, et cetera, on Korea and China, that if they were captured, they were to talk. They were to tell them everything they knew. Better to do that than be tortured. They figured, as they told the officers, the other side's going to know all the information anyway. And these were valuable assets of the military. They didn't want to see them destroyed in prison or whatever. And after the Korean War, and the revelations of this came out, caused a huge controversy in the press. That's how I discovered this. And it was in the pages of the New York Times. Later, it was all hushed up. But for a little window of opportunity, say roughly in 1954, this news came out and then it was clamped down. You never heard about it again. Oh,
No.
so Overholser. And so then I said, Overholser was hired by the Warren Commission. What's that about? And so I just proceeded to try and find the documents. It led me to make requests to the National Archives for more documents and to do some, internet sleuthing. And that's what I came up with was
Okay, well, let's tie that to that ties back to Jolly West to me, the Korean War conversation,
Oh, yeah.
biological warfare, because Jolly West, really, he kind of got his start, working with those folks, right? That had come back, and there was some conversation about whether or not there actually was biological warfare, germ warfare. That's certainly disputed in historical texts. Your research has shown that there, in fact, was. Is that correct?
Oh yes, and in 2010, I could go into all the different reasons I believe that to be true, but in 2010, the CIA, on the 60th anniversary of the beginning of the Korean War, released a set of documents of which were declassified, highly secret communications intelligence or signals intelligence, decrypted messages from communist, that is North Korean and Chinese military units to other units or to headquarters about what was happening, you know, in their field of battle. And I found approximately 32 instances, which were came out in about 20 documents, in which the CIA declassified statements by the communist military units that they were being attacked by biological weapons, and that they needed DDT, or they wanted more vaccines, or they wanted more instructions about what to do, or they were wondering how we should address this. And in a few cases, they were you know, talking about, we have to watch out for false stories about this, like, you know, we are we need to really investigate this well and not let, you know, not let false reports go out. So this stuff is major. I mean, you don't get better documentation than this. And of course, American historians don't want to report it. And to this day, except with one exception, I'm about the only person to really report about this. So I'm more than anyway. So yes. So Jolly West was interrogating, returning, as were other psychiatrists. He wasn't the only one. Other, you know, handpicked right. psychiatrists and psychologists investigating, probing, interrogating the returning confessors of biological warfare, as well as other people who were deemed to be collaborating with, you know, their communist captors. Mm-hmm. So Jolly West, yeah, whether he got his start exactly with that, it certainly helped accelerate his career. And
right. And then he eventually was working directly, reporting directly to Sidney Gottlieb, and had some correspondence with him to his other pen name, Sherman Grifford, I believe. But so when Ruby meets with Jolly West, he then, believe it or not, such a surprise, has an acute psychotic break when the
right.
You know, the six psychiatrists who had seen him before all said he was doing just fine.
Right.
So yeah, that seemed, you know, the legal term for that is res ipsa loquitur. It's right. The thing speaks for itself. If, you know, if you have something where it's like, you know, the classic example is a fish in the milk. Well, there must have been a problem at the milk bottling factory because there's a fish right. in the milk, right? So it's like, well, you've got the guy whose job it is to sort of melt people's minds going, and he meets with Jack Ruby, and sure enough, the guy's mind is melted.
Absolutely. Yeah, what a coincidence.
Colloquially, but you know what I mean? Like,
right. But I will say this, though. The earlier psychiatric examinations of, in fact, one was by a guy by the name of Manfred Gottmacher, who was, it turned out, referred with Overholser to the Warren Commission. But the Ruby people got him first. And he did an evaluation of Ruby in early January of 1964, and it was highly condemnatory. And putting, you know, Ruby was a guy who could explode. He was very violent. You know, so it wasn't, you know, what they were saying is that, yeah, he was sane from a legal standpoint, which later, of course, after he saw West, he was not, or supposedly was not. And that from a legal standpoint, he was sane, but of course, he was still, you know, and that he had had a temporary kind of insanity, if you will, a kind of a epileptic episode that they called it. And when he was just so distraught, and he killed Oswald, just in a spur of the moment impulse, violent impulse, because he was a violent, impulsive man.
Right.
So that's how they set him up. Just as the, is what I write about, just as the Warren Commission, with the help of, you know, CIA linked psychiatrists, in particular, not Overholser, who had developed heart trouble and in fact was to soon die, but Overholser's successor, Dr. Dale Cameron, and another guy who had actually worked with MK Ultra and the artichoke program of the CIA, which was, you know, using drugs and hypnosis, et cetera, experiments on people. They're the ones who came up with the idea of, you know, Oswald was trying to be a great man. Oswald was trying to be a, you know, masculine in relation to his wife and all of this stuff. But mainly they had been called in because they were, could be counted upon to rubber stamp whatever the Warren Commission and its CIA backers were going to say about Oswald. And it was, you know, so they, if you wanted dependable people to do it, you would use government-linked psychiatrists, and that's exactly what they did.
All
Unfortunately,
right,
no
so
one's ever commented on this until now. It's kind of
yeah,
amazing.
well, your Substack article does a really nice job laying everything out. So let's get into, I guess before we pivot to talking about your work, just want to get your sort of summary, if based on what you know, what do you think was going on with Jolly West and Jack Ruby? I mean, is that a coin toss for you? Do you lean one way or the other? I mean, it's easy to kind of make jokes about, but what is your gut?
Right. Well, at first I say the guy who's written a lot on this is Max Arvo, researcher, and
Excellent.
he had a series done at Kennedy's and King website, and listeners should go see that too. But my take is that it's still a circumstantial case. But circumstantial cases can be actually quite powerful and quite strong. Sometimes you don't have a signed document, particularly when you're dealing with intelligence agencies. You're not going to find, I don't think we'll ever find a document that says, my name is, Lewis J. West, and, I drugged Jack Ruby, gave him LSD, made him insane, and then framed him. You'll never find that. But I think that is if something like that happened, and I don't know that it was LSD, but something, and they quieted him up and kept him in the hospital for as long as they could, or in jail rather, as long as they could.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you that it's unlikely that there would be a smoking gun document. And, maybe there is a smoking gun document, and then, 63 years later, 62 years later, it gets delivered to the Director of National Intelligence Office, and then apparently it gets taken back. That could be a thing that happens. I think we can safely say that it's healthy to have skepticism about any actors who are opining on this, and this is sort of a political football, the Kennedy assassination generally, which is kind of makes me sad because it used to be something that was like American as apple pie. It was the thing everybody still agreed on was, well, I know certainly Oswald didn't act alone to kill Kennedy. There wasn't a lone gunman. Everyone agreed. And now it's kind of, and it was, sort of a thing that was popular on the left for a while. And now it's sort of right coded to care about the JFK assassination. And the point is, it's just an interesting time because there's all these different figures all over the place. Solving JFK, my whole thing is I want everybody, all political
Right.
perspectives are welcome to talk about the subject. But it's really hard to know what to think about this whole thing with Tulsi Gabbard and the whistleblower saying that the
Right.
documents were taken, and then it's like, well, then later they came out and said, well, that whistleblower was wrong. The CIA did retrieve the documents, but there wasn't a raid. And then it's just, it's hard to know what to think. I mean, and I'm sort of, I'll let you respond here. Sorry, this is monologue. But
That's okay.
I was so excited when the Trump gave his order that he was declassifying everything, and it's been the most material declassification in a long time, and it's a lot of stuff that has been helpful. Nevertheless, there are still more than 1,000 documents, or about 1,000 documents, that remain, and we just need a lot of it's book record keeping. We're unclear on what even is out there. It's just a big mess. But the point is, it's not over, and we need our elected officials to help us get us to the goal line on just the disclosure. Forget the investigation part. But what's your opinion on all that sort of current events that's happening?
Well, I of course, my ears, were burning when I heard that a number of the documents that were requested were MK Ultra documents. Now, why would, the investigation into JFK's assassination be looking at MK Ultra documents? Now, obviously, anyone who's followed and read all sorts of things on the JFK assassination has to have at some point come across things such as, well, Oswald was a programmed killer, or he was a Project Monarch when he was, 10 years old, and he was made into an assassin. And I don't believe any of that stuff. I don't necessarily disbelieve it, but there's no reason for me to believe it. I don't see any documentation. But on the other hand, here I am, and there's documentation. I see that an MK Ultra doctor was one of the main people put in charge of constructing Oswald's biography. And I'm not talking about Overholser, I'm talking about Dr. Howard Rome, who was the President-elect of the American Psychiatric Association in 1964, when he was hired by the Warren Commission to be one of three primary people, the other being Dale Cameron, Overholser's successor, and another guy from the federal prison system, which, by the way, is where Edwin Walker, where he was working when General Edwin Walker was there for evaluations. I wonder about that too, but that might take me farther afield, and it's just a supposition. But what was Howard Rome doing there? This guy, and I put out in my article, if people can read, in 1955, which was, about 8 years before the assassination, had been, we have the documents of a very detailed visit by the CIA, Artichoke Program people, which were, for your listeners, Artichoke and MK Ultra, well, yes, technically are different programs. There's a lot of overlap in exactly what they were researching: drugs, interrogation, how to construct, how to wipe people's minds clean. Yes, how to program people as well and try and control them, mind control. What was one of the, and this guy was had also been a consultant for the NSA at the same time. What was he doing working for the NSA, working with the CIA? And here he is, right in the, meeting with Allen Dulles and John McCloy and the staff members on a July afternoon in Washington, D.C., to come up with what they're going to say in the Warren Commission report about Lee Harvey Oswald's life and why he killed Kennedy. Is that they believed it. It's quite clear that that was the, not only in the press, but in the Warren Commission itself, for the most part, few exceptions, they were going to follow out. They'd already made the decision it was Oswald, and they were going to back that. Although they had left, some of them had left open things, so maybe he had an accomplice, whatever. But you asked me about this. So yeah, I think it's very suspicious that these documents were taken. It could be a misdirection. Yes, there's 1,000 documents or whatever that we're waiting to see. But the documents that I wrote on that you were speaking about here today, about the CIA-linked psychiatrists working for the Warren Commission, they've sat there for literally decades. Anyone could have looked at them. The documents I found about a declassified decrypted military, overheard communications from the enemy about how they were being bombed by the United States with biological weapons. Those had sat out there for a decade before I came across them. Who's looking at, what are people doing? And I could come up with many, many other examples. Most of my writing comes from things I wrote about MK Ultra. Gave a detailed example to a program they had called MK Decoy, which was kind of a sub program of MK Ultra, in which the CIA was working on a device that would cause people to have concussions at a distance. Poof, I do something at you, poof, and I give you a concussion or brain damage from a distance without even touching you. It was, the program was advanced enough, it had its own code name, MK Decoy. That information also had been sitting out there in CD-ROMs and online at places like the Black Vault for decades. There's so much material out there to be still to be looked at. I when I say misdirection, I wonder, are we waiting and are we seeking documents, hoping for a smoking gun when reality, maybe the smoking gun or something like it is already sitting somewhere on a server, just no one's ever looked at it?
Yeah, that's just like the routing of Oswald's CIA documents. The metadata tells the story. His documents should have gone to the Soviet Russia division, and they went to the Office of Security, and no one's ever explained that. And there's not really a good reason why, unless he was being used in a spy game. And then the only argument comes that, well, maybe he was unwitting, maybe he didn't know, and yada yada yada. But anyway, let's get into
Oh,
Overholser
he was,
and your work. He was brought in first by John McCloy, and the way that he was brought in was a little confusing to me, because McCloy, and by the way, McCloy, obviously he's a Warren commissioner. He was the chairman of the Ford Foundation, which they're kind of integrated with the CIA for operations and grants. And McCloy is the one that wanted to bring Overhauser in. And at first, it was to untangle the autopsy mess, is what he said. And specifically, He said that he wanted to ask to have Overholser address why didn't they turn the body over, and why did the FBI report come out with something that's not consistent with the autopsy? And my biggest
Right.
question was like, why are you going to bring in a psychiatrist to ask about a gunshot wound autopsy? I mean, might as well ask a dentist or a podiatrist. Like, I didn't understand. Can you unpack that?
Yes. Subsequent research in my last article helped me with the timeline, and it helps me understand what I think happened. Overholser wasn't initially brought in by McCloy. At least he was brought in by another guy by the name of Thomas de Beauvoir or whatever. The J. Lee Rankin, in the first week or so of the formation of the Warren Commission, went to this guy who was a Rockefeller-linked politician in Vermont and said, "Get me some referrals for we want psych people to help us out here." And this guy de Beauvoir turned to a guy by the Vermont State Hospital named Dr. Rupert Chittick, who I lay out in my article is linked at least possibly with MK Ultra work. And MK Ultra work definitely seems to have occurred at his hospital, Vermont State Hospital, during the period he was there. In any case, he's the one who recommended Overholser first. And he recommended this guy, Dr. Guttmacher. I always mispronounce his name. Guttmacher, yeah, who actually was already going to work with the Ruby defense team. And so Overholser. So what McCloy did, though, is the first time we see anyone turning to Overholser in the early stages in the Warren Commission. Yes, and he wants to have Overholser look at the autopsy mess, as McCloy puts it. But I think it's because they're used to Overholser being a guy who they call on, an expert, to clean up their messes, to clean up the mess in Korea around the Korean biological warfare stuff. There were other instances to clean up the mess around Walker. It was very, he was supposed to also evaluate Edwin Walker while he was held in the federal facility in Springfield. But Walker's attorneys didn't want him, they didn't trust him. He just likes to commit people. They were worried that he was going to put something out and they'd put Walker away and never get to see him again. But he was a government man. He does their dirty work for them. And that's why I think McCloy said, let's get him, because he has authority. He's decades of accomplishments, World War II. Of course, they don't talk about the OSS truth serums stuff. But so I think that's what it was. But I think they, in the end, they dropped that because. But the same reason you just set up, I don't think they probably someone probably said, he's a psychiatrist. He's not a forensic, pathologist. We better get somebody else to help us with this.
So not so he wasn't a subject matter expert. However, he was trusted for high stakes matters and known to be
Exactly.
on that they would see things the same way, I suppose.
Yeah, the highest stake matters. You don't get higher than covering up super black operation like biological warfare. This
True.
guy was at the top. In fact, in the Warren Commission documents that I found, Earl Warren is saying to the other committee members, "Oh, you were here, you congressional people who are part of this committee. I'm sure you know who Dr. Overholser is.
Right.
He needs no introduction." Yeah, because he was a main medical guy, from the government.
And then his Overholser's successor, so he passes away, you said a heart failure,
Yeah,
and
64 he dies. Yeah,
for sure that wasn't a heart attack gun.
I know. I thought about it, but now I don't know why. I can't
Okay.
see a reason why. I
All
think he
right.
probably just really died of heart failure.
That happens sometimes. So
Yeah.
sometimes it's not the heart attack gun, believe it or not.
Right.
So anyway, Overholser's successor at St. Elizabeth's and also on the, with the Warren Commission, Dr. Dale Cameron. So in 1964, July of 64, he has this meeting with McCloy and Dulles and some staffers, and that's where they work up Oswald's psychological profile. I
Yeah.
just want to talk a little bit about that because this is the meeting, if I'm not mistaken, where they're basically like, well, if Marina would have just slept with him the night before, then maybe he wouldn't have killed Kennedy, and he was just like sexually
Yeah.
frustrated with his own wife and yada yada yada. It seemed absurd on its face. And it's kind of the type of thing, no disrespect personally, but the type of thing that Gerald Posner brings up in his books. It's just like it's all about like the point is, it's all about Oswald's personality and Oswald's subjective life, not about like this thing out to like the objective and like what he's doing, the people around him.
Posner d quotes Cameron. He says this was what the Warren Commission experts thought.
Right. And I guess it's just, I guess they didn't really run with that. You don't really hear people talk that, use that line that much anymore these days. But I guess, do you know what the, what was the thought process initially, that that was sort of the thing that they thought they were going to lead with, or were they just workshopping it, or like what?
They were really workshopping it. They knew what they were going to say in the broad sense of the term. Oswald was unstable. He had a troubled childhood. His mother was a monster. And they had all this kind of psychoanalytic stuff that he was really trying to think. He killed Kennedy because really he hated his mother, and he identified with his mother, with the U.S. government and Russia, and it's just all sorts of crazy stuff. And when you read all of it, it's mostly just psychobabble BSing. And sometimes the Warren Commission staff, anyway, not so much McCloy or Dulles who were there, will stop them and say, don't, they call them on their BS because they were there to kind of keep, they were the legal minds, and they were trying to, think, well, how can we write a good brief, really, is what they were thinking. This, and the legal staff was approaching it in the mindset, I believe, that we're constructing a legal brief. That's going to back our case, and we don't want to have stuff in there that's just outlandish theorizing by some guy that, Marina Oswald, if she had slept with, they literally said if she had slept with Lee that night, Lee would have slept in the next morning because he'd be so tired from the great sex, and he would have missed being able to assassinate Kennedy. That's literally what they talked about. But other, Dr. Rome, they said, oh no, Lee, his problem was he was dyslexic. And the frustration of this built over the decades until finally anything, it was like a match waiting to ex just touch it and explode. And that's what happened with Kennedy. It just in the end, they only kept one thing from this meeting, but it was an important thing. And that was Howard Rome, the MK Ultra artichoke specialist who was on the Warren Commission as a consultant and met with Dulles and McCloy at this special meeting, which was, by the way, a top secret meeting, wasn't declassified for some years, and said, Lee Harvey Oswald wanted to be a great man. And that was how, in history, and killing Kennedy was how he was going to do it. He might have wanted to kill somebody else. Maybe he wanted to kill Walker, but he didn't. And Kennedy would be his ticket to being the, and the quote, great man, you find later quoted again and again. That was the CIA's creation. That was it. The other stuff they just laid out there and let maybe people like Gerald Posner or other people pick it up to sort of throw more mud on the wall and confuse things to, as much as they can. And they also, made sure that these psychologists wouldn't throw any thing out there that would possibly clear Oswald or at least throw great doubt. Interestingly, by the way, Cameron was the only guy in everything I read who a couple of times said, well, maybe Oswald was innocent, but, and then he'd say all this crazy stuff. Just the fact that he would even do, I guess he felt he had to at least make nod formally to that. But he would say things like, oh, yeah, by the way, and this literally something like this is how it unfolded in the meeting. He'd say to Dulles and McCloy, I never, you never let me, he was complaining, he was whining really. You never let me talk to Marguerite Oswald. I never got any details about what happened in Russia. I never got this or that about his military record. So I don't know what I'm really talking about here, but let me tell you what I think. And then he'd run down this whole thing about how Oswald's insane and, how his mother created him into a monster. And, these guys are good at covering their asses. And, and BSing in forensic settings. I've seen this in the real world too, in courtrooms where I had to face down government attorneys trying to get torture victims thrown out of the country. So it's the same kind of thing in my mind, except here it's working at a very high level to help cover up a major crime against the society.
Okay, so I've never been a huge weed person, but this guy that I know, let's just say, is. So whether you're like me or the guy I know, or you're really into weed, whatever it is, you're about to nerd out big because there's this company called Mood, mood.com, that's changing the way people buy cannabis. Here's the science, and this is the part I love. The reason different cannabis strains make you feel different ways isn't just about THC, it's also based on other components called terpenes. Terpenes influence how your bud tastes and smells, but they also affect what you feel. So one terpene might make you feel uplifted and energetic, and another one makes you relaxed and sleepy. There are dozens of these. So when you have the right combination of terpenes, you can feel social, focused, creative, aroused, chilled out, or whatever. You just go to mood.com, click Shop by Mood, and that's it. Want to be more social at a party? There's flower for that. Need to focus and get more work done? There's flower for that. Want to melt into your couch and watch movies? Yep, flower for that too. And here's the part few people realize. It's now 100% federally legal to have really great bud shipped right to your door. It's third-party lab tested and comes in a discreet box. Best of all, everything is backed by Mood's 100-day satisfaction guarantee. And like I said, you can get 20% off with code JFK. So head to mood.com and get 20% off of your first order with code JFK. You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact that you might not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with discounts that are easy to come by. In fact, 99% of their auto customers earn at least one discount. So visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, so the third, a third person, and there's, I think, more than maybe just these three. I think there's several of these CIA connected psychiatrist that you talk about, but Dr. Bryant Wedge, who he was at Valley Forge Army Hospital during Project Artichoke experiments, the ones that on returning Korean War POWs, and he is going to visit with the Warren Commission on January 29th, 1964. He's in the logbook. So do you know kind of what he was up to? And I guess it just shows it's one more person that has this connection between, you know, mind control, artichoke, MK Ultra style operations, and showing up to advise a Warren Commission.
Yes. Well, we know that he corresponded with Overholser, but we don't know what they talked about. And for, if that exists anywhere, I haven't been able to find it either in Overholser's papers or in the National Archives. It may be there, and I'm just not looking in the right spot. Maybe it's in one of those 1,000 documents that they have out there. I don't know. I wish I knew, because Bryant Wedge is a very suspicious fellow. I think that my own personal take, my guess, and you know, educated guess, is that Wedge heard about what was happening, and he wanted to get involved. These people think very highly of themselves. And this is going on, and he calls his colleague over, writes to him, Overholser, you know, because Bryant was, you know, has worked for the CIA in constructing biographies of foreign leaders, you know, for intelligence purposes, you know, at a distance, so they could better understand and supposedly do whatever shenanigans they wanted to do. And so he thought he was, you know, hot stuff. And I think, you know, he tried to get involved or offered his services perhaps to Overholser and therefore to the commission, and either they didn't take him up on it or they did, and I and no one else has so far discovered exactly what he did.
Yeah. I want to talk about another document that you came across, and so, you know, when we think to movies and we think to, like, you know, this whole thing of like the CIA and the national security state, they can do anything they want. And one of the things that you hear threatened is, "Hey, I'm gonna throw you in an insane asylum," and then you go, "Well, this is something that's in the movies, but prove to me that that happened somewhere." And people go, "Well, that's the kind of thing that's hard to prove." You came across a document, a 1980 memo, a CIA memo on St. Elizabeth's, that basically said that there was an arrangement where they could basically send anybody who was a problem for national security purposes, or potentially exposing sources and methods, they could send them to St. Elizabeth's, and they would be dealt with as if they were insane, and St. Elizabeth's wouldn't ask any questions. That's huge.
Well, there were two things. One was there was a document that said since 1959 we've had this formal relationship with the CIA on admitting people that they wanted admitted, family members, agents, assets, in quotes, and then there was a later document that went into greater detail about how this arrangement, it was something like a memorandum formalizing, this is my understanding of our agreement kind of thing. And the agreement was that there was an ad hoc committee made up totally of just CIA people, right, from their Office of Medical Services, the Office of Security. I'm not sure who else. I'd have to look back and see, but there was like four or five different people on this ad hoc committee, and it would decide if it would recommend who needed to be done. And sometimes those referrals were just for purely security purposes, not mental health. And yeah, St. Elizabeth's wouldn't act. There was no medical, just on the CIA say so, they would psychiatrically hospitalize somebody. I reached, and by the way, it wasn't just St. Elizabeth's that was, this was the second document included the V Veterans Administration. So the St. Elizabeth's was kind of sold, if you will, or traded off from the federal government to the DC government some years ago. So I didn't bother to try and see what they had to say about what happened when they were under the feds, because it's a different administration. But I did call, contact the Veterans Administration to ask them to comment on this and just ask them if they still had an arrangement with the CIA. Well, of course, they never returned any of my calls.
So surprising.
So, yeah. But yeah, it's shocking. I mean, it really is the level of, I ask myself sometimes. I think it's the historian Al McCoy, Alfred McCoy, has studied a lot the torture program and the MK Ultra stuff, and he said, really, the psychological and psychiatric establishment, particularly the psychological establishment, had been completely suborned by the CIA during the early Cold War, and it is true that much of the large, not large, the higher profile psychiatric and psychological establishment had connections with the CIA. People who, it's quite shocking to me as a psychologist, is to find out that some of your quote heroes that at least you were taught to believe and you're reading their stuff, early on, people like these names will mean nothing to most people, but people like Henry Murray or people like, oh gosh, I'm blanking on his name. Anyway, a lot of famous psychological people, and they had worked, not just people like Jolly West, but well-respected people in the treatment community, like psychotherapy, had worked with the CIA, wittingly or unwittingly. And some of these people, as I said, both Overholser and Howard Rome, two key figures in my research, were presidents of the American Psychiatric Association. I mean, these were major figures with intelligence connections running America's psychiatric establishment.
So in terms of like a parallel between the Korean War biological warfare cover up and the psychiatric involvement on the Warren Commission, how do those things align? And it kind of sounds like, I'm going to answer the question I just asked you based on what I think. It kind of sounds like what you've laid out, that they just kind of all knew each other. It's the psychiatric establishment, and they're just kind of, that's who's working with the CIA, and so that relationship would continue forward to the next thing, which happened to be the Kennedy assassination. Is that right?
I don't know if it was the next thing. There were other things in between, but yeah, I mean, basically, you have these people, and they're in positions of trust, and so if you need them, an example would be in 1946, I think it was, anyway, not long after the end of the war, the daughter of the Army's primary biological warfare. Or chemical warfare, biological and chemical warfare service in Japan. Their main guy who was stationed in Japan, his daughter was murdered, in a horrible murder. And they pretty much looked, when I looked like, and Overholser was involved with this too. The government wanted Overholser to come in and say how the guy was insane and stuff. The army was rushing this through so fast, they didn't want any, publicity or anything. There wasn't time for him to get from DC, so Overholser didn't get his chance to hop into this one. But they did turn to him, and they turned to other people. So the idea is that they have a select group of people who they bring in when there's scandal or there's cover up that are trustworthy and that they know can handle whatever, throw out a lot of BS, whatever the BS might be, and in this case, psychological mumbo jumbo stuff. Because the general population can't assess things like incipient epilepsy, like with Jack Ruby, or
Sure.
legal insanity versus whatever the population thinks is insanity. All these things, and then you shove it through really quickly, and then what you're left with is the imprimatur of people with MDs and PhDs and professorships and Legion of Merit medals. That are respected members of society, and they're the ones who say what is. So that's the link here, I think. So you have a, speaking in a leftist sense, you have a ruling class, and these are the higher echelon of the servants of the ruling class in the professional fields who serve their government when they're called upon. They
Sure.
did it in World War II when it seemed noble, and then they did it again a few years later. And onward, including in 1963, 64, they did it again. And I think they still continue to do it.
Right. And based on everything that I've studied so far, and I still have much more to go, I find your work to raise even further suspicions, right? Like, it seems to confirm everything I've already seen, everything that I already thought, everything that's in Gerald McKnight's book behind me, the great book on the work of the Warren Commission. But my question, just to sort of look at it from the other side, what would you say to somebody who goes, okay, everything you're saying is true, good job, but the implication for that is not, I mean, what do you say to someone who says, look, just what you said, these people all knew each other. So they called their friends. Merely calling their friends doesn't mean that there's some conspiracy. It might just mean that they were, can you say that they weren't acting with complete propriety? Sure, but that's meaningless for, analyzing a conspiracy. What would you say to that?
Well, I say this, there's a possibility, and I even address that towards the close of one of the articles that, yeah, I mean, if you have a group of people and they're well connected and their friends are well connected, it's like a clique. And this clique is the one who gets called upon, and they do all their friends, they do the forensic psychiatric work. And in truth, they did know each other. Many of them for over the years. In some cases, they knew each other well socially as well. But I would say you have to start putting a lot of coincidences together until finally the probabilities start to become problematic. Why were the meetings of Rome, David Rothstein, and Dale Cameron with Alan Dulles and John McCloy made to be top secret? Why weren't they just declassified, or why weren't they just released when the Warren Commission results were released? What was the need to cover them up? That would be one question. I mean, of course, why pick top level people who were involved? I don't know. I'd have to sit actually and make a case as to all of this. It just seems to me there's too many coincidences.
Right.
to be, why, so for instance, I was hoping when I was looking, I had no idea what to look for when I was trying to track down who recommended these psychiatrists to the Warren Commission. And when I found out it was a guy, Thomas, this Vermont attorney, I said, okay, well, let's see. Let's read the letter. I got it from the National Archives that he sent to J. Lee Rankin, giving his testimony as to who was re required. So who does he get the information from? He gets it from an MK Ultra doctor, Rupert Chittick, from the
Right.
Vermont State Hospital. And I laid out all the case about Rupert Chittick and who he is in my article. I can't repeat it all here,
Right.
but that's another coincidence, right? And
Yeah.
coincidence. Who does he recommend? Winfried Overholser, major intelligence. So yeah,
Right.
maybe they knew each other. Actually, I don't think that Chittick knew Overholser at all. I think that he just knew of him. But I
Yeah.
think anyway, just
That gets at a concept that I talk about sometime, which is coincidence threshold. Like, what, how many coincidences? Because coincidences happen, certainly. But I think people who are on the Oswald did it alone side, they're real quick to go coincidence, 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 coincidence. But I mean, it's just they kind of pile up, and then you go, this is, I'm looking at a page of 900 coincidences, all of which I have citations to the official record for, like, so
Right.
that's kind of how
Well, here some of my training can help a little bit. In the world of psychology, we study statistics. And when you look at statistics, there are all sorts of psychological studies. And one thing they're trying to do is they're saying, does the fact that, let's say, people who drink a gallon of water a day or have clearer minds than people who don't? Anyway, so you would run some tests, and then there would be the group that does and the group that doesn't, and there would be the probabilities involved. But the more you start adding in questions, the more probabilities start piling on each other, the more the possibilities become very, very strange. So, for instance, if you have A, B, and C, I hope this isn't too technical. If you have A, B, and C coincidences, what's the probability that they're all coincidences? Well, you multiply A times B times C. You don't add them, you multiply them. And now you end up saying, well, if the probability of the first was, let's say, 3 out of 10, and the probability of the second was 1 out of 10, and the probability of the last was 8 out of 10, well, then you would take those percentages and multiply them. And what you end up coming up with after a while is a very tiny figure. Well, the probability of all of them being true, even though coincidence, is infinitesimal. And that's what I
Sure.
think you have here. So instead, you have in psychology, they have the standard of either 1 in 100 or 5 in 100 as being is something that's due to something real happening versus a coincidence. When you pile up all these coincidences and say, well, they're all coincidences, then you have to assume that everything is, that almost nothing is possible. I mean, everything can
Sure.
be a coincidence for that matter.
Sure.
I think that it means we're having to overlook a lot of stuff. And
Yeah.
why the secrecy? Again, my main question back is then, well, okay, then why the secrecy? If everything is so clear and simple, why do they have to go out of their way to construct, some kind of a demonizing portrayal of Lee Harvey Oswald when they
Yeah.
didn't even have the data to do it? And they admitted they didn't. And yet they did it anyway. Why
Right.
was that?
Yeah, I couldn't help but read your work through the lens of thinking about LBJ and Hoover's conversation the day after the assassination, where Hoover, and I talk about this all the time, so people who listen to all the episodes are probably tired of me talking about this, but this is sort of my main soapbox. LBJ hears from Hoover the day after the assassination, hey, Oswald's down there talking to this, there's an Oswald imposter at the Soviet embassy in Mexico City. And then Hoover follows it up with a memo to the White House, memo to the Secret Service. No one ever walks this back. Hoover never goes, my bad, we were wrong, I was mistaken, right? But then LBJ uses his conversation with Hoover And a we know from a famously recorded conversation with Senator Richard Russell, where he's referencing the conversation that he had with Earl Warren and how he made him cry because he said he brought up a little incident in Mexico City that Hoover told him about. Where and what's the incident? Oswald supposedly meeting with the head of assassinations, Kostikov, in Mexico City,
Right.
in September. Well, we know from the written record, and by the way, it's a whole separate story in terms of where's the tape, and it was erased intentionally. We do know, but anyway, the written transcript says that it wasn't Oswald there. But then LBJ turns around and uses that. So that whole idea is hard to not look at the official investigation and to look at, for example, we just got done covering the Soviet Union on solving JFK. And one of the things in this recently released Russian document dump was notes that the Soviet UN ambassador had he wrote a memo back to Moscow right after hanging out with McCloy at a cocktail party. And McCloy says to him, he goes, hey, or no, he I don't know who went up to who first, but basically he asked McCloy, hey, how's it going? And McCloy goes, oh, Oswald acted alone. He definitely killed him. And then McCloy kind of says to him, but you understand that really you guys probably did it, and it looks bad. So and then when the Soviet ambassador was like, I don't know what you're talking about, he's like, so anyway, yeah, Oswald did it. Like I said, Oswald did it. So I say that to say, that's a long way of getting to, we see all of these psychiatrists who are trusted psychiatrists, meaning they're not going to freak out, they're not going to go rogue. That's the main headline, is they're not going to go rogue, and they have the institutional stamp that's going to give them the credibility that you need. And look, maybe they literally were all patriots, and certainly we know that they were because they're covering up war crimes, some of them, right? And the point is, could they, I guess, what is your take on, is it possible that they were told, hey, the Soviets did it, we got to point this toward, we got to pin it on Oswald alone, because if we go down that road, basically that the Warren Commission believed what Johnson was telling them, not all of them, not Dulles and probably Ford, but certainly Earl Warren, I would say, like who seemed to be the most gullible of all, sadly. Maybe he wasn't. I'm reading that wrong. But anyway, what's your take on that? That whole possibility that, hey, maybe these guys were just going along because they thought that that it was a conspiracy, but it was the Soviets.
I listened to those episodes of yours, by the way, fascinating stuff on the Soviet Union release of or not the Russian release, I guess not the Soviet Union anymore. But did they turn, people like Rome and Cameron or Overholser, these things, I think these people, as I see them, had sold their soul to the devil years before. I think that you didn't need to say anything to them. All you had to do is, they're careerists, and they really looked, they really brown nosed the government people. They, that doesn't mean they didn't hear stuff while they were in, meeting with commissioners or staffers, or they didn't pick something up, along the way. But I don't think that it would have been, I think they would have done what they did anyway. I don't think they needed that motivation. Not these guys. These guys were made, for most of them, they were made men in the apparatus of, I mean, when you're letting people be psychiatrically and voluntarily hospitalized in your facility for which you have primary responsibility, and you know that there's nothing necessarily medical about it, and you're letting a police or intelligence agency like the CIA do that, you're a made guy. You don't need them to come to you and say, oh, do this or the Soviet, we're going to have World War III. That's what I
Good
think.
point.
But it doesn't, I could be wrong, we just, I'd way have to see the evidence. I'd have to see something pointing in that direction.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a really good point because I was thinking just in terms of like how they had the institutional connection, but then to think through, well, what are they doing exactly? What is the string that's pulling them all together? And it's like, oh, doing experiments on people against their will without their knowledge, like, That's bad guy. That's bad guy behavior for sure.
Well, for instance, this guy Harold Rome. If you read the my article, or you read the linked documents about the 1955 visit of the CIA to the Mayo Clinic where Rome worked, and the University of Minnesota where he was a professor, and the reports by a CIA guy, and he's writing down, this is what Rome told me, this is what we said, this is what we talked about, and other doctors as well. But Rome is saying, hey, have you heard about this guy Donald Hebb? He's doing great work in isolation and sensory deprivation. You could use that to interrogate people. And then later in the conversation, he's so enthusiastic about helping the government. He says, well, wait a minute, you've said a few things here. We could never experiment on our own patients. We're healers here. We don't do that. But if you have other people, not our patients, who you need our expertise, and you have unwitting or you have resistant experimentees, and you want to do your stuff, we'll help you on that. We'll help the government, just not our own patients, because I have ethics, don't I?
You don't want to cross
That's
the
how
line.
they saw it. That's how they, people like Jolly West, others, their ethical souls were gone early on, or they would never have risen as high as they did, I believe. They wouldn't have had the trust from the CIA and other, not just the CIA, I think military. When I say CIA, I include in here military intelligence, who obviously was involved somehow also. I believe.
I guess just to sort of tie a bow on our conversation, I mean the big thing that is interesting is that all of the doctors that were all the psychiatrists that were relied upon by the Warren Commission actually had a long history with the CIA going back to OSS and also Artichoke and MK Ultra. Not maybe not all, maybe that's not correct,
All but one.
and key the key one. So yeah, basically all. And I guess the reason that matters is because it's not the report that it's not the objective report that we were told we were getting, and also it's kind of the opposite. It's a conflict of interest. So it actually matters a lot, is my perspective on that. But what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And so people like Dulles, by the way, sitting there in the room with people like Howard Rome and Cameron, he knew who they were. They had Alan Dulles knew exactly what the links were. Nothing was said. And McCloy too, he may have known as well. I mean, McCloy, I put right up there just as high as Dulles. I know people see Dulles as the main villain, but I think both of them, McCloy's intelligence connections were just as tight and good as Alan Dulles's. And he'd done, and he was a very nasty man, John J. McFly. Guy who was, your listeners may not know, was the guy primarily responsible for the internment of the Japanese in World War II, for letting Nazi war criminals get out of jail early after the Nuremberg trials. I mean, this was a guy, he was a nasty man, very powerful guy.
Decisions that he vigorously defended. I know the Japanese internment was.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
So, well, yeah. So great work on that.
Thank
And
you.
what do you have? You started to talk about your project you're working on right now with the Japanese
Yeah,
bioweapon.
well, another thing that I found, a document that had been sitting out there once again, unremarked, as I found more than one. It was a document that said that remember when the Chinese balloon flew over the United States and there was a big hullabaloo? This was what got me started. I said, well, some news story or something, and said, yeah, it reminded people of when the Japanese at the end of close towards the end of World War II sent balloons with incendiary bombs over the United States and Canada, draw you know to which was an amazing, and actually a few people were killed in Oregon. So I started looking into it, and one thing it did, by the way, is it took out some power lines to the Hanford complex of the Manhattan Project, and very temporarily slowed down the construction of plutonium at the Hanford complex for the making of the bomb that would drop on Nagasaki. So I started looking into this, and I've always been interested in Unit 731 and Japan's use of biological warfare. And certainly this comes up in terms of the Korean War controversy over biological warfare, because the communists claimed that the US was working with Unit 731 personnel in doing this. Of course, at the time, the United States denied there was even such a thing as Unit 731. or that, and certainly that there had ever been a deal made. Those things were kept secret for 40 years. So anyway, what I'm working on now is just a continuation of that story. It turns out that I mean, the story goes that the United States gave amnesty to the Japanese biological warfare scientists because so that they could get their data for use in their own biological warfare program and keep it out of the hands of the Soviets. But and I like to look at little things, little threads that no one notices and no one's pulled them. And so I think I'll pull them, see what comes out. In this case, there was a little thread in the document saying that a copy, you know, that the records of the biological warfare program had been destroyed in the firebombing of Tokyo, one of the firebombing attacks, namely the night of April 13, 14, 1945. And they bombed the Army Medical College and all the records of biological warfare research went up in flames. But it turned out that that was true. But what they didn't tell you was a copy of those records had been made and shipped off to another city called Niigata on the west coast of Japan. And I saw that there. So I started looking for more information, getting Freedom of Information with the National Archives. And I just got, and I got a statement from at the time, contemporaneous from Army investigator Dr. Murray Sanders about how they had found the records, a copy of the records in the Niigata, and they were going to send them back and have them translated. And then they would really know what was going on with the Japanese. But this was before the offers of amnesty. This was before, even while the Japanese were denying experiments and everything. So actually, there were, so in other words, the Americans had this information before the amnesty was even made, or at least they had the bulk of it. And, you know, I think they went ahead and made the amnesty anyway because they could never be sure at that point. But whatever happened to my point is, what happened to that archive? Just disappears into history, into the vaults of the darkest corridors of government secrecy. I don't know, but no one's ever written about it. So I'm writing about it, and
Good.
we'll see where that goes.
Well, good. Well, hey, it's been great talking to you, and everyone needs to go check out Jeff's Substack. It's at kj.substack.com, kaye.substack.com. And he's got a lot of great articles there. Definitely go check him out and support Jeff. Solving JFK listeners, we'll be back with one more bonus episode before I go on a little hiatus. I've got Andrew Eiler and Mark Damczyk, JFK Records Act attorneys. And experts on that topic, good friends of mine as well. And they just got back from the National Archives with a crew of serious JFK assassination researchers. So we'll be talking to them about their findings and also the current state of the JFK assassination records. And after that, I'm going to be taking a break until about November to read, research, and outline before embarking on the final stretch of season three of Solving JFK, where we're going to get to covering Cuba, Cuban exiles, the CIA, and the generals. And I'm looking forward to digging in and reading again and listening instead of writing and talking and speaking all the time. So that'll be a good season, and I'll come back ready to go. But once again, thank you, Jeff K, for your time. You're awesome, and appreciate your work on this topic and many other ones that matter for people who value freedom and honesty and transparency from their government.
Thank you very much, Ben, for having me.